Is that a Bootsy Collins slap bass intro to the podcast? Is that what you're kind of going for here? A kind of slap bass,
you know,
it
was really
kind of thing.
Speaking of instruments that are getting a resurrection, I don't know if you're aware of this, Jeff Merrick, but a lot of pop songs today are incorporating the saxophone. The saxophone is back in a big, big way.
Hang on, Ariana Grande's
Problem.
Which saxophone?
Jason Derulo's
tenor, the tenor sax, the baritone sax. What are we looking at here? What kind of saxophone?
Well, that's what I was getting at. So Jason Derulo's Talk Dirty to Me, I believe, uses I'm going to guess a tenor sax. I would guess Ariana Grande's Problem uses an alto sax. I'm excited because apparently Taylor Swift's song Shake It Off has reincorporated the baritone sax into popular music, and I couldn't be more excited about that. Even though I was not a sax player in high school, or actually middle school, I wasn't in band in high school. Although I dated everyone in the band, I was in band in middle school, and I played the trumpet, which I wasn't good at. And then when they learned I wasn't good at it, they did what they do to anybody who's not good at the trumpet, which is they make you a baritone player, the mini tuba.
Ooh,
me and two other people were playing the mini tuba. I went from being, the prominent on the risers. You were on the risers if you played the trumpet. You were center stage on the risers to off on the wing behind the trombones is where you go.
I can remember grade 9 band specifically, we all had to fill out what instruments we wanted to play. A lot of the guys wanted to play drums, and I had played drums before a couple of years of my life, and I filled out my card and I got to play drums. My friend Mike Marks, who wasn't there that day, had a doctor's appointment or something like that. He said, "Can you fill out my card for me?" And I said, "Yeah, sure. What do you want to play? What are your top three?" And he said, first I want to play, you know, drums and percussion. I think second was probably saxophone, and third was, I don't know, trumpet or something, like a cooler instrument. And you're in grade 9, he's your buddy, so what do you put down for all three? Tuba, tuba, tuba. And for 2.5 years, my good friend Mike Marks had to not only play the tuba, but carry the tuba back and forth from Humberside Collegiate Institute to his home on Indian Road in the west end of the city.
That's brilliant.
Absolutely. Hey, was there ever an instrument that you thought was goofy that one musician turned you around on? Because for me, it was trombone. I always thought trombone was the instrument you played at the end of a punchline. Wow, right? I always thought that until I heard Fred Wesley of the James Brown Band, like that great funk machine with like Maceo Parker and all them dudes, Pee Wee Ellis. When I heard Fred Wesley play trombone, it completely turned me around on how effing cool the trombone can be. Is there an instrument like that for you, Greg Wyszynski? Is there a Fred Wesley out there somewhere that turned you around on, I don't know, cymbals on the knees, or that turned you around on the ukulele, whatever? Is there? And maybe
Obviously, the banjo,
Tally
DeShane Martin, would obviously
Tally,
be aware.
Tally DeShane
right there.
Turned you around, and Tally DeShane
with
ukulele. Ukulele.
The trombone's funny though, because my best friend Andrew Stanger actually played trombone in high school and in college and in middle school, and so I appreciated the trombone well before I needed anyone to have a revelation for me. And in fact, he is a level of trombone nerd that is unparalleled. Where we'll be at a club, say like Groove in the Greenwich Village, and after the show, he'll linger, not to, you know, meet the singer or meet the guitarist or talk about music or buy someone a beer. He'll linger to meet the trombone player from the funk band. So while we're all waiting at like 2 a.m. to get out of the club and go, separate to the Four Winds, we got to hear him standing on stage going, "So when do you use the spit valve? When exactly do you know when you use a spit valve?" I'm just like, Jesus Christ, man. Come on.
Let's
get out of here.
45 minutes talking about breathing. Breathing into the trombone. What types of breath do you use? So when you're playing a string of eighth notes here, what type of breathing are you using?
"Excuse me, sir, but how do you lubricate your slide?" You know,
it's really
in life.
It is the weekend, after all. Yes, it is the weekend.
Indeed, it is. It is the weekend. It's a Friday show from... Well, I don't remember. Merrick vs. Wyszynski Friday show. We didn't have a show all week together, pretty much. So I decided to let Merrick off the hook. We're not doing game show today. It'll come back soon.
Aww,
also,
man.
I know a lot of people are really waiting for us to announce something for Toronto, because I'll be up there next weekend. And I can say that it's going to be Sunday, I think, was the day that we said it's probably going to happen. I can say that it'll be later in the day, so like 4 o'clock NFL games, if you needed to know. We're still working on a venue, and we'll let you guys know ASAP. But block off a little time Sunday night for a little meetup for MVSW listeners.
Nice.
The big news.
Wait
the
a
NHL,
minute.
There were two pieces.
That's next Sunday. That's not this Sunday, right?
Next Sunday, not this Sunday. No.
Okay.
I'm moving to New York City. So if we want to have an MVSW meetup at my new place in New York and save me some dough on moving and have a cool move, that's fine. I could afford the pizza, but no, I think more people would have fun if we did it at a bar in Toronto, personally.
All right. Oh, by the way, our good friends, Puck Buddies, Puck Buddy just tweeted in the best idea. Idea for Wyshynski and Merrick and MVSW, Gay Show Friday.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
That would be amazing.
Why don't we just let Puck Buddies 1 week do Gay Show Friday? Just hand the whole recreation of the entire block over to them.
That would be amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Bunch of questions about Ryan Kessler and the body issue for ESPN.
Yeah, I don't know. There was some 70s
commercials. Can you tell us the exact coordinates of his hands on that rock as he posed naked, Ryan Kessler?
Oh my.
That's a good question. Two things that I've always wanted to do for the show, and we'll do them eventually. One is, of course, the Hockey Feud. A Family Feud style game involving hockey fans, which will happen eventually, maybe this season. Yeah. And then the other one would be some level of dating game. And doing a gay hockey dating game with the help of the Puck Buddies would be pretty amazing, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm cool with that. Yep, I'm down with that. Sweet. The other thing that I've always really wanted to do on this podcast is talk. Just, you know, like talk to each other and just talk to people and then stop. And then you go and download something else off iTunes.
So in other words, maybe just, you know, not doing a game show is what you're trying to say?
I'm just saying, no, there's room. Listen, under this umbrella, there's room for all of this. I just like it when we start talking and then we stop talking.
Well, there you go. We are talking a bit today because there's no guest because we have a lot to get to. What do you want to talk about first? The demise of 24/7or the slate of new rules changes for the National Hockey League?
Might as well do the rules change. I mean, HBO's 24/7 is gone, but I don't think that special is gone long term in the NHL. I think we'll hit that sort of perfect pitch that HBO did, but it's not gone. Mm-hmm. But the rules changes to me are a little bit interesting.
Let's get to the 24/7 thing later. I have some new information on that I can share, but we'll get to that in a little bit later. Rules changes. The question of the day: which one has you most intrigued? Going through a few of them real quick. So, the trapezoid. Okay. Let's all hunker down for a second and think about this. First of all, I screwed up the rule when I wrote about it yesterday. I spaced on what they were actually doing, which is expanding the area in which the goalie plays the puck. The trapezoid will be expanded by 2 feet from the goalpost on both sides of the net. So they've expanded the area in which the goaltender will be able to play the puck.
Yeah.
The trapezoid's a funny thing. Like, I think if hybrid icing didn't exist, the trapezoid would have been seen as a player safety issue, and we probably wouldn't have it right now. I think there was a little bit of movement within the league that said, you know what, those catastrophic collisions along the end boards could be lessened if you allowed the goaltender to play the puck. And I think hybrid icing has sort of taken that out of the equation a little bit. I don't get what this rule does. I don't know why they did it. I don't think there's a necessity for it. I'm sort of baffled why they even addressed it.
There are people in hockey operations who feel the exact same way that you do. Why are we doing this? What is this? Why are we expanding this a couple of feet? You know, the more interesting point is allow goaltenders to play the pucks in the corners, but not right behind the net.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's to me is the more, if you want to. So when you get out there to play, if you have the stones to go out there and play a puck and act as a third defenseman, Marty Turco's not around anymore. Marty Brodeur's close to not being around anymore. If you want to go out there and play the puck, God bless you, because if you mess it up, hello scoring chance in a huge way. But if you can play it, if you are a goaltender that can go out there and has that skill set, shouldn't the league be rewarding it? That's what I've always maintained. Shouldn't the league be pointless? Look at how this goal look at how Marty Brodeur behaves with the puck in the corners. This is pretty fascinating for a goaltender to do that. Because once upon a time, I mean, people would marvel at what Jacques Plante did with the puck and how he moved around with it. This Marty Brodeur was a whole different creature altogether. So was Ron Hextall, for that matter.
On principle, I don't like the idea of any rule created to take away a skill from somebody. And that's essentially what the trapezoid does, is it takes away stick handling from a goalie, and I hate that. The two things I will say, though, the counter-argument to that is that you sometimes get goalies playing catch during games if you allowed too much puck handling from a goalie. And the other thing
is... Do you really think that's true?
But, I mean, it's the sense of, like, long lead pass, misses, that kind of thing.
But that's what this game has become, though. Once you got rid of the center line, it's become a long lead pass game.
That's a fair point.
That's what they want.
The other one, though, listen, in a perfect world, no trapezoid, goalie goes out, plays the puck, is fair game as a third defenseman. You can do what you please with him. But that's really the issue. It's not a perfect world. It's a world in which back in the Mesozoic era, before we had the trapezoid, you had goaltenders that would go out and protect the puck. They would turn their ass to the play and protect the puck, and then when someone would look at them, they'd fall down to the ice. Now, I know that in an ideal world, you'd have a lot of Marty Turcos and Marty Brodeurs and other Marty Birons, all the goalies named Marty, playing the puck like a third defenseman, getting involved in the play, becoming part of the offensive flow, except we have goalies named Mike, like Smith, who go down like a sack of flour whenever they get a chance.
No, but you understand there's a new diving rule as well. This does apply to goaltenders, correct? You're going to go after Pat Coletta. Yeah. You're going to go after Lapierre. You're going to go after the Montreal Canadiens. I want to see them go after Mike Smith, and I want to see Dave Tippett get fined because of it. That's the one I want to see.
Of course, yeah.
We're getting there too fast.
Right, because the NHL will totally do that and not risk the fact of, getting a bunch of goalies getting all boo-boo face saying, you don't protect us. You try to make our pads smaller and don't... God, yep, the most coddled. They make NFL quarterbacks look like the homeless guy in The Most Dangerous Game. Like, that's how hunted NFL quarterbacks are versus NHL goaltenders by comparison of coddlingness. Game misconduct penalties. This is a no-brainer. I don't know why this wasn't in place anyway. Here's a crazy thought. If a player incurs two game misconducts for clipping, charging, elbowing, interference, kneeing, headbutting, or butt-ending, then they get an automatic one-game suspension. Wouldn't two game misconducts for any of these things warrant a suspension well above one game? I guess they just need to have this in the books in order to do that, suspended indefinitely thing before they actually lay down the law.
Specifically elbowing, because elbowing, even when I grew up, I mean, I remember plenty of 2 minutes for elbowing penalties. I mean, I'm sure you did as well. Everyone listening to the podcast growing up, I'm sure you all remember 2 minutes for elbowing. There's really no such thing as 2 minutes for elbowing anymore. Now it's like two games or 15 games for elbowing anymore. It is an infraction that has gone off the 2 minute docket and gone right into suspension. So I'm with you. That one goes right into suspension territory, the elbowing one.
It's so crazy to think that, like, a guy...
What is a two-minute elbowing penalty now?
You would have to imagine it's using your elbow to ward off somebody and then conking them by accident. Like, wouldn't that be a two-minute elbowing penalty? But then again, that depends on the severity of the conking is really the issue there. Anyways.
Yeah, I don't know.
Penalty shots. This is where things get interesting, ladies and gentlemen. The Spinorama move has been banned from penalty shots. No longer permitted in the penalty shot or in the shootout. The Spinorama is dead, sir.
I ask why.
Well, let me answer your question. The reason why is because there is that element of confusion about the puck having forward motion. Like, if the forward motion thing is in the rule book, and it's in the rule book to make sure that there isn't any, ridiculousness put into these things where guys are getting too fancy pants or trying to skirt the rules or getting in close and jerking the puck around and really putting the goaltender at a disadvantage. If you're going to have that in the rule book and there's always questions in the Spinorama whether the forward progress of the puck has been stopped, I guess they just feel like get rid of the spinorama. So that's the answer to your question in short form.
Don't buy the forward progress rule for a second. You understand, like, when players stick handle the puck, they're pushing the puck forward and pulling it back. It's called stick handling. So forward motion.
But there's motion to that, though. But there's motion to that, though.
You're already going
forward. I think the problem with spinorama sometimes is they feel like the progress of the puck stops. Like when they
why does it have to be constant forward motion? And the reason I ask this too is, are you allowed to do a spinorama in a regular game? Regular 5-on-5 play. So why not in the shootout or the penalty shot?
It's not fair to
goaltenders. And I'll tell you why. It's not fair to goaltenders. But there's already the call for... I think what we've seen more times than not is when a player cuts in, he gets remarkably close to the goaltender, shades the goaltender off, interferes with the goaltender, putting him out of position, and then scores the goal. To which I always say, don't ban the spinorama. Just call that a non-goal. You have a call in your book. It's called right. You have interference. You say, nope, that's not a goal. You bump the goaltender on the shot. That's interference. No goal. Next shooter.
Well, that would be logical. Rather than illogical, which is this. And the reason it's illogical is this. Like you said, there's something already on the books that you can use to police an illegal move like that. But the essence of the shootout is what? It's to artificially end the game so we don't have overtimes into perpetuity. It's to get rid of tie games so we always have a winner so Americans can like hockey. And it's to put a spotlight on star players doing star player things. You know who's not a star player that should be doing star player things in a shootout? A fucking goalie. Goalies shouldn't have a spotlight on them. They are the Washington Generals of hockey in the shootout. Mm-hmm. They're there as a mannequin for guys to do amazing things around and through. I don't think they need any other benefit. F them. They're not even we should play with a Scoro cardboard cutout instead of goalies. They're not factors. Nobody's paying to see a goalie in a shootout.
You're saying bring out the goalie caddy? Is that what you're saying? Bring out the goalie caddy for
shootouts? I'm saying bring out the thing with the five holes that we all learned to shoot on and have that instead of a goalie because no one gives a shit about goalies in a shootout. And the idea that we're doing anything to placate them because, oh, he confused me with his razzle-dazzle wizardry with the puck. Shut up. Yeah. Who cares?
Yeah. Well, I'm just glad that you're on my side of things with the shootout. Congratulations. Welcome to Progressive Hockey.
Well, no, I have always been on your side of things on the shootout. In that regard, which is that if we're going to have this monstrosity, then we should gimmick it up any way you can. I mean, the idea that we're going to have any rules, decorum, oh, you've got to keep your helmet on. Oh, you can't do this move. You can't do that move. I would be fine if a player loaded up a puck in a t-shirt cannon and fired it from the blue line. Like, who gives a shit? If you're going to do
Here's
this
my
to
question.
End the game anyway,
Here's,
just gimmick it
okay.
up.
Remember when Linus Omark scored that shootout goal against Tampa and he started out with his spin at center ice? Uh-huh. If he did that now, would the play stop?
Yes.
So before he's even got to the blue line, you can't spin at all.
It doesn't say spinorama in the offensive zone. It doesn't say spinorama near the crease. It says spinorama. At any point.
Just in general.
Spinorama is illegal on a shooting attempt. Now,
if you do the spin around, but don't take the shot? We've seen that. Mikhail Grabowski's done that a couple of times. Do the spin around, don't take the backward shot, pull it between your legs, and then take the forward shot.
Well, hold on. We would have to go actually read Rule 24.2 because that explains what a spin around move is. This simply says that you can't do it anymore, but we'd have to go look in the rule book, and I'm too lazy to do that now. Video goal judge, some interesting changes here. I'm going to write about this in depth on Puck Daddy after the show, but basically here's what you need to know about this. The video review rule has been expanded to include a little bit more of the intent to blow situations. Not all of them. Basically what the NHL is saying is this. In those situations where we see the puck cross the line and kind of like hide in the corner of the net, hello, I'm a puck. You can't see me. You know, like right there.
Yeah.
If there is a significant couple of beats between the puck visibly crossing the line and the referee blowing the whistle, the war room can call down and say, listen, we know you blew the whistle. We know you lost sight of the puck, but this is a good goal and it's going to stand even though you blew the play dead. Currently, the way it is a referee blows the play dead. It's dead. You can't do anything about it. It's just a dead play. Now they're saying if we have evidence of the puck crossing the line and there is a significant maybe 2-beat gap between seeing the puck cross the line and the referee ending the play either with his whistle or in his mind, the goal will count. Other bang-bang intent to blow rule things don't, but this one they're going to review.
Yep, I like it.
Yeah,
I like it. I've maintained for a long time this game is too fast to call as accurately as people expect it to be called. And this is just a further nudging up of the eye in the sky, really actually calling the games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I talked to Mike Murphy today from the NHL about this rule and some other stuff, and I said, you know, like, are referees cool with it? Essentially, this is a thing where
they want this.
They want more video review. They want expanded video review.
100%.
It's not exactly shaming them in a situation like this. They want. They want accuracy. It's not their fault they're not in position to see the puck cross the line. You know, it just happens to be a situation where there's a pile of bodies in front of them. So they're cool with it. The NHL's cool with it. And now the tricky part about this is going to be obviously what is an acceptable amount of time between the puck crossing the line and the whistle. And then we're going to have comparisons between one goal that counted and then one that didn't count, even though it was a nanosecond less. You know, it's going to be one of these situations. But they're getting closer to trying to make it where intent to blow is not the killer of goals that it is now.
I can't argue with this one. I think it's a good. There's one thing that I do want to eliminate from the hockey lexicon since we're already talking about hockey. Can we stop saying good hockey goal and just say good goal? That's a good hockey goal.
Do you also not like calling them the New York football giants? Because they used to have to say that back when the New York Giants were there before San Francisco. They still call them the New York football giants here in the city.
Yeah, that's gone. It's like calling it ice hockey. You know, it's hockey. Yeah. We can see the ice. It's okay.
Well, I feel like if you're in New Zealand, you can call it ice hockey because field hockey is so prevalent there that they call field hockey hockey and they call ice hockey ice hockey. That's why the Australian League is the Australian Ice Hockey League.
Yeah. I guess where field hockey is prevalent. That's fine. But here, let's just call it. We just call it hockey, and we just call it good goal as opposed to good hockey goal. Just stop. There's no reason.
Or
to
in some middle
in
some
sport,
middle schools,
we know what the sport is.
Some middle schools where the children are very promiscuous and they play a lot of tonsil hockey. I'd be fine if that's called hockey, and then it's ice hockey as well.
Wow. Oh my goodness. I have no idea what you're talking about. Now, you want to talk about 57?
I listen, kicked in goals is something that I know you're passionate about because you think everything should count, right?
Dude, there was one goal last year that Brandon Dubinsky scored with his skates where he put his right skate behind his left skate as he was moving forward and tucked it in. Dude, that should effing count as two goals. The Columbus Blue Jackets should have had two goals on that play that was kicked in and not even allowed as one.
All I'm going to say, National Hockey League, is look at the ratings of the World Cup and then ask yourself why we shouldn't have more kicking in hockey.
You can kick the puck anywhere, just not over that red line for some reason. I do like, it's so funny because when you look at so many videos, it is such a fine line that you're walking between distinct kicking motion and not a distinct kicking motion. Do you find that? Like some videos that you watch, you say to yourself, oh, clearly distinct kicking motion, but nope. It's still so much part of interpretation. That's why I say, let it all in, including, you waiting for it? Not throwing the puck, but batting the puck in. You want more goals? Here's a way to do it. The goalie equipment's not getting smaller. The nets aren't getting bigger. How do you increase goals? Allow the puck to be kicked in and allow it to be batted in with the hands.
Also, 2-minute power plays. But I don't like that. I'm fine with the kicking thing because I think kicking is a part of the game and other parts of the ice, like you said, the batting thing gets into a little bit of a hazy area, don't you think?
Maybe, maybe not. Still a skill play if you can bat it in with your hands.
But kicking the puck to your stick is a fundamental. Batting the puck to your teammate's not a fundamental. That's handball.
So we're introducing a new skill into the game. You should be applauding this.
That's right. Okay. Yes. The forward pass was one innovation, and now knocking the puck around to your teammates like you're playing handball is the next innovation of hockey. Perfect.
That's right. In 1913, they introduced the forward pass, and in 2014, batting the puck in is groovy.
Rule 57 is tripping, and I find this one kind of interesting because it changes a part of the game. For those who have not read the rule, basically a 2-minute minor penalty will be assessed when a defending player dives and trips an attacking player with his body, arm, shoulder, regardless of whether the defending player is able to make initial contact with the puck. So no
this
more of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he
got the puck first.
He
got
slid
the puck
across
first,
the
okay.
ice, but he got the puck first, so it's no penalty. Now it's a penalty whether or not you get the puck first.
Yeah, makes it easier for the officials too. But I gotta say one thing. Aren't you impressed at how many times you see that exact play and you say to yourself, oh man, there's no way he touched the puck first. And then you look at it on review and all of a sudden it's like, oh yeah, man, he got the puck first.
Yeah.
Like it kind of, isn't it kind of a cool play? And you're getting, you're getting, because that skill is so unique, you're getting a mulligan on the trip. Like I understand, yeah, it's a trip and you should probably call it a trip, but the skill set before it to actually have that sensitivity to poke that puck off of the stick before the trip occurs. Don't you think that that's, you know, so highly skilled it should wash away the minor? Like I know why they're doing it, and it's probably the right thing, but man, I love that play.
As usual, the NHL is trying to have their cake and eat it too on things like this, because they do have a second part to the rule, which is that if you do that, if you dive and get the puck first on a scoring play, no penalty shot. Still, like it is now, but you still get a
minor.
Penalty. You get a minor,
get a minor
for it. I don't know. I'm with you. I think it's an exciting play. It takes an amazing amount of skill to be able to pull that off. I understand that there is gray area when this stuff happens, but I think more often than not, the referees do get it right. I don't think there's a lot of plays where it's like, he touched the puck first and he was railroaded on that call. I think a lot of times they get that call right, and at the end of the day, it's a really skilled, good, solid defensive play. I do wonder whether this is a rule, though, for player safety, because the idea that you're basically taking a guy's skates out from under him and then you're both sliding into the net or the end boards or anything like that, it can get a little dangerous. So I wonder if this is a player safety move versus anything else, because otherwise it is a pretty exciting play.
It is. I'm curious to see now what players do instead. Like, now, is it just going to be the free pass league? Because that seemed to be the last thing you can do when you missed your assignment, guys behind you, and it's your all-out desperation play. Now, if you're a defenseman and you're trailing that player, what can you do? Do you just leave him? Does that turn into almost a penalty shot because you can't touch him? Because you're behind, you can't hook him, you can't trip him, and you can't pull the desperation play, which is the Hail Mary, which is I'm going to try to poke this puck away, knowing that I'm going to take out his feet too, but I'm going to try to time this so the puck goes first before the feet.
Yeah, it does seem
What do you do?
Intentionally forced breakaways, it seems like they're trying to do. Well, I guess what you do is, if you know the guy has you beat and you can't dive to knock the puck off his stick, you throw your gloves in the air and grab your face and pretend that he nicked you with something on his body, and then hope that they blow the whistle and end the play.
We're going to get to diving now, right? Is that what you're going for?
Yeah, we are.
Because
we are.
Can we just call this the Michel Therrien rule? Can we just call this the Montreal Canadiens in the playoffs last year rule? Because I remember talking to people last year while the Habs were in the playoffs. I'm not picking on Montreal. It's just the word going around the NHL. They were so livid at Montreal last year for the embellishment that it was insane. And to think that that wasn't encouraged by Michel Therrien, who's done that his entire career, is folly. Can we just call this the Montreal rule now? The Montreal 2014 playoff rule?
Every postseason has some team accused of it. Vancouver got nicked with that. The Hurricanes for a very long time. We were the diving team.
This was Montreal last year. And Hockey Ops hated it. They couldn't stand it.
That reputation visits a number of teams at different times. Diving and embellishment's the next rule we're talking about. Supplementary discipline penalties for diving and embellishment have been increased, and now they're outlined as well. If you dive once and get caught, you get a warning. Twice, $2,000. Three, four. Five, you get $5,000, and it's $5,000 each time after that. But what happens after the fourth offense is that your coach gets a $2,000 fine for your actions. Now, two things here on my end of this. First off, God bless the NHL for finally nicking and going after – I'm going to say nicking. I've said it a lot lately – for going after the coach on these things. I don't necessarily know if a coach is as culpable for a player diving as he is for, say, sending John Scott out to rip someone's spine out during a game. But the idea that we are going to discipline coaches and general managers for the actions of the players that they choose to put in their lineups and that they pay to be on their teams is a very novel concept, isn't it? Shouldn't we then spread the punishment to the other people that could actually affect their behavior on a local level. All politics is local. All change is local. If you want to get these nasty, criminal, injurious elements out of the game, guess what? Hold the teams accountable, because they're the ones that are going to put the pressure on these guys. Mary Lemieux, Matt Cook, it all starts on the team. It doesn't matter how much you fine these guys or suspend them. It all starts with the team.
There was a presentation that we had at our seminars this week at Sportsnet at Rogers. And they showed a number of different videos, examples of how they're going to enforce the new diving rule. And in just about every case that they showed, Wish, I came back with the exact same thing. If that player doesn't dive on the initial penalty, he doesn't get the call. Hmm. And that's one of the problems here.
Yeah.
There are some instances where if you don't go down and if you force yourself to stay up, you know what? You're not getting the call and that guy's getting a scoring chance.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this one gets tricky. And there are like some significant players. Like they showed one with Drew Doughty. I remember saying to myself, I was saying, they might have been John Shannon. We're sitting there. I'm like, if Doughty doesn't go down, do they get the call? It's like, no, they don't. Diving's a tricky one. We've been through it numerous times in the podcast. Show me the line between embellishment and diving.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody diving, embellishes.
Diving's a tactic. It really is. But I think there are guys that do it egregiously, and this at least gives the NHL some mechanism to go after the guys that do it egregiously, and that can't be a bad thing. But the other facet of this besides the...
But here's the thing. Hang on.
Yeah,
here's the problem. Here's the problem. And this goes back to the post-lockout 204-205, where, you know, embellishment is a new hooking. The moment the NHL went to this zero-tolerance policy on hooks, for example, anytime you have a stick near the hips... What were players encouraged to do? Where once upon a time you fought through it, now you're encouraged to go down because they're giving you the call. Mm-hmm. So if you want to talk about the NHL wanting to have it both ways, isn't this an example of it?
It is. It is. But I think what they need to do now is follow through on it. That's the real issue for me on this. It's not the money. It's not the increasing fines or bringing coaches into it necessarily. It's, are you going to be as open and candid about the guys who get hit with diving as you are the guys who get suspended by player safety? Because long time, maybe last year, they were talking about putting lists of divers, posting them inside of locker rooms.
Up in the rinks, yeah.
Remember that? Yeah. And like, it's going to take public shaming for these players to really change their behavior along with the fines and everything else. And I wonder how candid they're going to be about these guys getting hit with diving fines.
There is going to be some player out there that really hurts his career with a coach that he just cost $2,000, $4,000, $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can assure you, coaches don't like, well, no one does. No one likes going into their pocket for someone that's something that someone else did and shelling out $5,000. Mm-hmm. It's funny, one of the players that I was talking to, like turned analyst at our seminar this week, said, oh man, can you imagine how pissed off this coach, Coach X, would be if I got my, what is it, fourth dive and it cost him $2,000, I might never see the ice again. There's bad blood created between some coaches and players over this.
I think if you get to 10 diving penalties in a season, then you just stop getting calls. That should be the 10th infraction. No matter what happens to you in the game.
You can do it.
The other play, yeah, it becomes
free
the
pass.
Purge. Yeah, it becomes the
free
purge
pass.
Anarchy for everybody else on you. You don't get any more calls. Someone could literally walk up and stab you in the stomach, and they wouldn't get a penalty for it because you've reached your 10 diving penalties.
Look the other way. I got about 10 minutes before I got to go. I got to punt. You want to race through face-offs and OT?
Well, real quick, face-offs is pretty easy. That's the infractions for delaying face-offs after an icing, which is just a criminal act, and I'm happy they're going after it.
I called the last one tongue-in-cheek, maybe not so tongue-in-cheek, the Montreal rule. Can we call this one the Boston rule?
Yeah.
In all fairness.
Or the
veteran, if the last one's the Montreal
the veteran
rule,
team rule. The veteran team rule. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I prefer to think of it as the Boston rule, just in all fairness to our friends in Montreal.
Switching ends.
Listen, they're one of the biggest offenders. I'll tell you, here's what switching ends is interesting. You know what overtime, switching ends prior to the start of the overtime with the dry scrape?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if you're a goaltender, okay? And you're about to start the overtime. Uh-huh. And you know you're not going to get a flood, so it's not going to be a perfect sheet of ice.
No.
And you're looking at your goal crease. Mm-hmm. And you say to your goal crease, I'm not going to see you now for the rest of the game. What do you do to the goal crease?
You.
Do you not chop the hell out of it with your skates?
Chop the hell out of it. You do.
Right?
Yeah. That's exactly
Is there going to be a call on that?
No.
Are we watching goaltenders? Billy Smith was famous for this. But are we going to see a return of Billy Smith chopping up the goal crease? When I saw they're going to switch ends prior to overtime, I thought one thing, Billy Smith, chop up that crease. So the goaltender gets down and all of a sudden, like, what the hell am I skating in?
Yeah. There's zero chance someone like Tuukka Rask isn't going to do that, by the way. Zero.
Oh, everyone's going to do it. Right? You could be sure. That would be courage to do it.
Finally, puck over the boards or out of bounds. This is all about where the face-offs are after it goes over the thing. As I said on the blog, I care so little about this rule because we still have the puck over the glass rule. And it's, you know, listen, I know that there are proponents to puck over the glass, and I understand that. I don't like the idea of there being constant delay of games because of that being a tool that defensemen can use within their own zone. I just want there to be common sense. Like, there are so many times, like, you know, the NHL seems to be going common sense with a lot of these rules changes. Why don't we have one where the referee can use his discretion to say, you know what, this thing that happened, this guy, he didn't intend to delay the game. That's not what he wanted to do at all. He just effed up. He just effed it right up. And I saw this happen, and in my judgment, I don't think he intended to do that. What's wrong with that? Why can't we do that?
Because there are so many variables, specifically at the end of a period where the ice, I just mentioned choppy ice, where a shot towards the glass in the first 10 minutes has a lower percentage chance of going over the glass than it does in the last 10 minutes when the ice is of worse quality. Common sense says, yeah, leave it at the discretion of the officials, much like it's at the official discretion whether that was a trip, whether that was a dive, whether that was a high stick, whether that was offside. There's just this one thing that is the automatic. And you know what? You can argue whether it's, and I know you're on the against side, the con side for the automatic penalty for puck over the glass. But you know what I can't stand? You know, this has produced something that I just can't stand about games right now. When the puck goes over the glass, what does the other team do? They stick their thumb in their mouth and they start crying about it, pointing to the shot and then whining to the referees. It is such an ugly moment in the game. Hey, look what he did. Hey, he can't do that. It's such a sucky part of the game. Don't you think, Wish? Doesn't that look like diving is pretty sucky, and we all see it in soccer. We go, oh man, just please don't let our game become that. Don't you feel the same way when you see the automatic penalty for the puck over the glass? The other team just start, pull out the pacifiers and start sucking. Yeah. Oh man, he shot the puck over the glass. It's gotta be a penalty. And the hometown crowd does it too. It's gotta be a penalty. It's gotta be. They start crying on the ice and going up to the officials. Like, it's such an ugly moment, as ugly as diving is in soccer. I just can't stand it.
Yeah,
just looks sucky.
Yeah. It really is. And then the referees have to all get in their little coffee clutch and be like, "Did you see anything? Did you see anything? Oh my God! How did it go over the glass? Did it? Wow! Where's your strings? Did it just transport?"
I was wrong about something, and thankfully wrong when this rule was first introduced. I thought, because as a defenseman, I'm thinking to myself, "Geez, I don't even want to take a chance. If I want to clear the zone, I don't want to take a chance doing it high off the glass. I'm just going to fire it into the bench." I thought for sure more defense would just sizzle pucks into the bench. We get tons of injuries. Thankfully, that hasn't happened, but I thought for sure that was going to be one of the byproducts of this one. Because if you're a defenseman, why take the chance? Just fire it in the bench. Take the face off. Kill the play. Fire it in the bench.
After you, Boogie, I'll read some question of the day stuff, and I'll also get into the 24/7 thing. But real quick before you have to go, your thoughts, Nino Niederreiter gets a 3-year deal with the Wild. A very, very good value, $2.66 million against the cap.
Yeah, now where are you at on Nino Niederreiter and where he's going to actualize as a player?
I think he's a great player, and I think he's in a good situation there, and I think he wasted away for a few years on Long Island, and he's going to in a real good spot there with Minnesota. Yeah. I love his skill set. You seem to be asking that question because you don't believe that he's going to be good.
No, I like him. I'm just curious where they use him, right? If you're the Minnesota Wild, like, do you think he is a top six player with the Minnesota Wild right now, or is he playing with?
Well,
you know, is he playing on a third line with Matt Cook?
That's the problem with the Minnesota Wild right now, is that one of the drawbacks of the Vanek deal was the fact that one of these
look good.
Some of these young players are not going to get their shot, and Niederreiter is one of them. You know,
yeah, I mean,
they have
you got
top six.
Zach Parise, Mikkel Granlund, Jason Pominville, Thomas Vanek, Mikko Koivu, Charlie Coyle. Take your pick on that right side of the second line. You want Charlie Coyle or you want Niederreiter?
Coyle.
And to me, so much of Minnesota right now revolves around what you're going to do with Kyle Brodziak. Because I'm not sure that having a $3 million fourth line player makes a whole lot of sense to me.
No.
To me, the whole there's a blinking signal there saying this guy's getting moved sooner than later whenever someone needs a centerman.
He exists so when Niederreiter signs his contract, everybody can say, "Oh, look, he's making less than Kyle Brodziak." That's why he exists. And the other thing I wanted to bug you about, Craig Custance of ESPN has done some really bang up work at the media day earlier this week with the NHL. He asked all the star players there, 14 players, who is the player you'd start your franchise with? He wanted three players, first, second, and third names of the player you'd start a franchise with. The top five names in order: Sid, Taves, Weber, Rask, Stamkos.
No McDavid?
Well, he doesn't count yet. He's not in the league.
Oh, he's got to be in the NHL. Personally, I put Taves first over Sidney
Crosby.
That's
what the GMs... That's what's funny about this. The executives put Taves first when ESPN did that poll. The players put Sid first, and Sid by a pretty wide margin, too, over Taves.
That right, eh?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you'd have to put more stock in the guys that... Well, maybe not, though, because that's a PA issue as well, and Sidney's a pretty powerful guy. Now, do you put more stock in players saying Sidney because they play against them, or do you say, well, they're just saying Sidney because he's the most powerful member of the Players Association?
I think they say Sidney because they play against him. I really do.
And they know that. Well,
because here's the thing. Like,
if you ask those same guys, and don't forget, too, he's still the economic engine of the NHL.
Right? Here's the simple question about Jonathan Taves. Okay, here's a simple question. Okay. Could Jonathan Taves, on his own, get you a playoff spot? Or does his value come from when you get into the playoffs and he does everything you possibly need to have you win a cup? Because Sid gets you a playoff spot, and no matter what the situation.
I wonder, and you can say the same thing about Sidney Crosby too, but what is the effect on the other players that see Jonathan Taves and how he performs and how he composes himself, whether it's a player like Brandon Saad coming into the organization, whether it's a veteran like Marian Hossa coming into the organization? How much of an effect is Jonathan Taves there?
Yeah. That's a good point. There is that intangible captaincy thing he has. Real quick, also, they put Rask fourth. They didn't say another goalie until 13th place. I would say that Lundqvist and Carey Price both were 13th place. I would say of the 14 players interviewed, I would not hire any of them as a general manager if one of your three franchise players is not a goaltender. I mean, for God's sakes, if you're starting a team, right, you might need a goalie.
It's 70-100, right?
Oh, and also
70% if you have them, 100 if you don't.
But the big news out of this, and burying the lead, of course, is that Claude Giroux is the only player to say that he would take himself number one as a franchise player. I don't know if you knew that.
Do you have a problem with that?
A player saying that?
It seems very unhockey, but I don't have any problem with it.
But it's great.
Don't you want someone that confident? Right. Don't you want someone that confident in themselves? I want every player to think that.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're lying. Well, like, if you asked Mario this question and he's like, Larry Murphy, shut up. Like, come on, man.
Well,
he would have said Yager.
Good buddy, or Pierre LaRouche.
Yeah.
He's a good buddy.
That's right. Sid said Jamie Benn. He should have said Kunitz, obviously, would be the thing you should say.
Sid said Jamie Benn?
He did.
Whoa, that's the lead. Wow. Really?
He said Jamie Benn. And you know what the most amazing thing about that answer is? Jamie Benn is not a Pat Brisson client. Nah. I was stunned by that. That's really off message from Sid. Hey, anything you want to say to the people before you go, sir?
Listen, I know I haven't been around a whole lot, and my schedule is getting tighter and tighter. This week was seminars for me at Rogers, and so thanks for the patience, and I appreciate all the snarky emails that I got all week long about no podcasts. I read all of them, appreciate all of them. It was a real investment week for us at Rogers. Seeing how everything's going to unfold and how this whole team is going to come together. We had about 200 people at the Shangri-La in downtown Toronto for 3/4 days of seminars and shoots and getting to know one another. And Not that I can sort of say too much about what's going to be involved, but put it this way, the way that this thing is going to look is a combination of all of your favorite sports shows all combined into one, to the point where, I remember talking to Kiprios a couple of days ago, he said, man, I don't know that our conversation is going to be able to live up to the brilliance that are the graphics of this show. Like, can we just show graphics for the entire intermission? Because this is a really stunning way to view hockey. I know we're going to take a lot of bullets up front because it's hockey, it's Canada, and we're changing it a little bit, and Canadians don't do well when that happens. But I think over time, people are going to really be impressed and I think pleased with how Rogers not just takes this seriously, because I think everyone understands the gravity of this, but is being both respectful to the game, but also moving the game forward. Look, so it was a big week for us, man. So thanks for putting
it
up.
We all know
absence.
What you're talking about. We all know there's going to be comparisons with TSN. My advice to you is that if you want...
Oh, no, it looks different. It looks so different. It looks so different.
My advice to you is that if you want the people that love TSN to love you, make sure that you're always looking at your Blackberries, and that if the news gets slow, write to the Canadian Olympic team. Write to the Canadian Olympic team.
Oh, you know what? That is so true. Let's project out 4 years. Okay, Canadian Olympic team. Now, here's when we come back from break. Jonathan Bernier, is he on the list for Korea? The panel debates and discusses next.
That's right. That's comfort food. All the TSN people will be like, oh, it's the same thing I always love. They're doing the four-year projection for the Canadian Olympic team roster. All right. Get out of here. We'll talk next week.
All right. Thanks, Wish. Talk on the weekend, bud.
Jeff Merrick, ladies and gentlemen. Very busy man. Yeah, he's going to be on your TV a lot, which is great news because he's the best at what he does. But yeah, a real busy week for our boy. In fact, yesterday, I believe he was doing a photo shoot. GQ Merrick. I'm going to be doing a lot more video work for Yahoo, by the way. And all I could think about is like how fit Merrick is and how not fit I am. And how like I really wish before I start doing video work that like maybe I got more in better shape. But that diet starts when I get to New York on Sunday. That's what me and Ruby have been talking about. Couple of emails, Lachlan, Mac_N_Tosh on the QOD. In my opinion, the most intriguing rules change is the developments made within Rule 64 diving embellishment. It seems like we've been talking within the 60 minutes and immediately following games when it happens, but the NHL has failed to address it aggressively until now. Before, it was 2 minutes once in a while, and the call was made in-game. Now, with the opportunity to review tape and really get the call right, the NHL will be able to label players and publicly denounce an act of embellishment. Yeah, that's the other thing about this, too. Like, we were talking about more in the context of a player's whistle for diving. But that's the real fun part about it, is that there's going to be the after-the-fact kind of diving stuff and the fines coming down on people. So that's good stuff there. Mark Stern, in terms of rule changes, I am most interested in the tripping rule change. The diving sweep check is the standard last-ditch desperation effort for a defenseman, and this rule has completely taken that away. As soon as any player sees a D-man dive and comes close to them, they are going down like the Titanic. I understand that the rule was made to avoid people crashing into the boards, but at least the D-man was able to get the puck first and avoid that. I think once this rule is in practice in games, it's going to have a much more serious effect than people think. You are correct, sir. And Merrick, I think, broke that down pretty well as to why that's going to be an interesting thing. Christopher Dickerson writes in, oh, you mean the batch of rules changes that would directly benefit the Devils of last season? Punches wall, puts on ice pack. As an inherently defensive-minded person, I am most intrigued by the widening of the hash marks as it pertains to blocking shots off the draw. More slapshot goals? Yes. However, I'm fairly certain that the rule change to garner the most intrigue will be the diving business. Whatever will insert entire Kings roster do, in a world where I do not think it possible to improve Daryl Sutter's press conferences, the NHL has managed the impossible. See, the Kings are another team that gets the diving thing for some reason. Penguin pelts on the trapezoid. Oh, great. Fleury is going to keep trying to play the puck now. That's what I always say to people that talk about the trapezoid and all that stuff is the fact that for every Marty Brodeur and Marty Turco, there was a Marc-Andre Fleury or a Roman Čechmánek. Scott Huntington, maybe a dumb question. What's so bad about the spinorama that they felt it needed to be gone? Too much of a gray area for the puck needs to be going forward, or they just want to stay off of ESPN forever? Again, like, from a a highlight package perspective, the Spinorama was a boon to the Shootout. It always gets put on SportsCenter. It always makes waves. It always gets on YouTube and gets posted on every blog. But they obviously feel like there are too many players trying to get away with stuff and putting goaltenders at a disadvantage in a skills competition in which the goalie is completely superfluous. So there's that. HBO 24/7 NHL, The Road to the Winter Classic is done for this season. Jacob Crispin writes in, I don't think it's the end of HBO 24/7, and from what I remember, they said they were never going to produce every Winter Classic, but I think they might come back. Listen, here's the thing with 24/7, the two variables that I think went into this decision by HBO. The first is cost. Now, this was a mutual decision by the NHL and HBO, by the way. I don't think it's been said enough. The cost was shared at the beginning between these two entities, and then a lot of it went on the NHL. So I think maybe they felt that if they were laying out that kind of dough to produce this show, maybe they should get more benefit out of it than being on a pay cable station with a limited viewership and not on, say, a television partner where they have a $1 billion contract with them. Hint, hint. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The other factor in this, though, is a creative one. And I've heard from some people about the HBO side of the ledger, and I don't want to be one of these guys that says the Red Wings and Maple Leafs killed 24/7. But because the show wasn't all that good last season, and that is a direct result of the subjects they were covering, not being as compelling as, say, John Tortorella, Ilya Bryzgalov, Bruce Boudreau, Alex Ovechkin, Dan Bylsma, Max Talbot, etc., etc. It's not as if the show itself was a mess. It's that you peeled away the details and the aesthetics and the personalities, and you were stuck then staring at the bones. All the flesh was peeled away, and you saw the skeletal structure of 24/7. And I think what people did was they took a step back at HBO and said, oh my God, we've fallen into a template in year three. Introductory episode. The episode where it's Christmas time. The episode where the two teams play each other. And we get all hyped up with dramatic images of the Winter Classic venue at the end of episode 3. And then the Winter Classic. The third season started hitting very familiar beats. To the point where there was a charity game that benefited the owner's charity. Like, very, very specific beats were being hit. Holiday party, charity game, Winter Classic, yada, yada, yada. And so I felt maybe that watching it, they were in a bit of a creative rut, and I've heard now when this decision came down that they kind of felt that way. They kind of felt like, okay, this is more of the same. I would argue that when you have an opportunity to do the Capitals again, do Ovechkin again, and then bring the Blackhawks into it on the other side of the ledger with Taves and Kane and Sharp and a lot of personalities on that other side, that the template could fit things a little differently, but I guess they felt like maybe it was time to reevaluate things. Understandable, but hey, what are you going to do? So 24/7, not on HBO next year. Where is it going to end up? Well, as you know, the creator of 24/7 works closely with the NHL and developed NHL Revealed for NBC last season. I don't know if 24/7 is going to be incorporated into NHL Revealed or if it's going to be its own entity. They will do a lead-up to the Winter Classic with these teams. I just don't know where it's going to be. The real question isn't necessarily where it's going to be or who produces it or where we find it. The question is going to be, what do you do with the rawness of it? NHL Revealed had profanities bleeped out. It did not reach the same level of candor that 24/7 did for whatever reason. I wonder two things. I wonder first how raw they'll allow this to be, and I wonder second if the NHL would be willing to hand off 24/7 to an independent production company and then have it on their partner networks. I feel like there's an aspect of 24/7 that worked because the NHL was simply a partner in it rather than the producer of it. And it was almost like you had an ombudsman being critical of the league and of taking a critical eye to the players. And it's not a lot of editorial content, mind you, but kind of peeling away the layers of public relations and media relations and the way that the league presents its own players to then present a different aspect of them and the teams. So I think that's a good thing. It's just a matter of whether or not they go down that road. We'll still have a 4-episode show probably leading up to the Winter Classic, maybe something grander. There's no question from an aesthetic standpoint they can still nail the look of it and get everything going. If there was any way to get Liev Schreiber to do the show on narration rather than whatever Zeppo Sutherland they had do the show last year on NHL Revealed, that would be great. But the bottom line is that 24/7 rewrote the rules for the NHL on television, and maybe we never get back to the incredible quality of those first two seasons. Hell, I mean, it's hard to do it. I still think that The Real World back in the day was an actual television program that was compelling and you cared about. And at one point, it wasn't a bunch of people that were self-aware and self-promoting and just trying to get on the challenge. Like, the same thing applies to 24/7. We may never get back to the incredible candor of the first two seasons. But the look of it, the access, the presentation of it, the trying to create a narrative story from this footage. All of that fundamentally changed the way that hockey's been presented on television and will continue to. And it's a cool thing to see. It's an easy access point for someone who is a casual fan to watch these shows. And it's also entertaining for the diehards as well. So they'll do it. They'll figure it out. Bummer it's not going to be on HBO, but it happens. That, friends, is the show. The final show that I do from this very room in my apartment in Alexandria, Virginia. A big blue room. In front of me is a shootout. I should take a picture of this room, actually, before I disassemble it. And let you people see what I stare at every day. When next we do the show, it'll be from New York. Either from the Yahoo offices in Manhattan, or from the comfort of our apartment in Chelsea. It'll be somewhere. Thanks to Jeff Merrick for being on his show. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Maddie for producing. We will have news of the meetup next week. Also check social media for that. And see you soon. Thanks, everybody. Bye. Thank you.